This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 16th of November 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme...
La France est en guerre.
France is at war.
Les actes commis
the
vendredi soir à Paris
in
et près du Stade de France
on,
sont des actes de guerre.
Friday evening, these are
ils ont fait
acts of war.
François Hollande there. After the tragic events over the weekend in Paris, we'll be asking big questions that have no easy answers. After more than 130 people were killed in the French capital, our guests Shashank Joshi and Tim Marshall will be discussing why the killers were attracted to a hateful ideology and what can be done to prevent its spread. Then, with one of the suspected gunmen believed to have potentially entered Europe as a refugee, we'll be assessing how that story might affect the future of free movement across the continent. And we'll also ask what the weekend's events mean for European values. With increased measures of surveillance and armed soldiers on the streets of Paris, will the country ever feel as free again? That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. Well, hello and welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Shashank Joshi, Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute for War and Conflict, and Tim Marshall, editor of the whatandthewhy.com and a foreign affairs analyst. Welcome to you both. There is, of course, just one story tonight, the fallout from Friday night's terrorist attacks in Paris, which have left more than 130 people dead. In the coming 30 minutes, we'll discuss the battle with ISIS and how it should be fought, what, if anything, this attack means for freedom of movement in Europe, as well as the impact it could have on the Western way of life. First, before we speak to Shashank and Tim, let's cross live to Paris, where Monocle's Daniel Jacopelli is standing by. Danny, you've been covering this story for us on Monocle 24 over the last 48 hours. Talk us through the sort of day it's been in Paris today.
Hi, Steve. So we have been kind of all over Paris today, but the only place to be really to see the action is Place de République. All the international media is there, international tourists are there, young French people, mourners, tributes. There was quite a scare last night. We've been talking about where there was a possible gunman in the square. They evacuated the square. Police took positions, but it turned out to be a false alarm. Nobody really knows what it was. I mean, people are saying firecrackers. So tense nerves outside of the main spots. I mean, near Bataclan, of course, there's a lot of mourners. Outside of the main spots, you wouldn't necessarily know that something horrific has just happened. I mean, people are on the streets. They're walking around. I mean, there's families around. People are eating on the sidewalks at restaurants. You wouldn't know unless you go to these main sites. I mean, on Sunday it was a bit somber. You couldn't tell if it was just Sunday or if it was somber. But if you go to Bataclan, obviously there's a massive tribute laid out there. In fact, there and a barricade much farther away from there. In République, lots of mourners, lots of candles, people singing the national anthem. Kind of, you have this surge of patriotism in some groups. There's a lot of spontaneity, a lot of people kind of breaking out into song, breaking out into arguments even, lots of people debating with each other, a really good cross-section of Parisian life, old people, young people, people from the suburbs and people from the city. Not violent at all, not really yelling, but it could be heated at times. It's quite an odd day. It's been a surreal weekend in general here in Paris. Hard to say how it's going to be going forward, but time will tell.
Danny Jacopelli in Paris, thank you very much indeed. And you can hear more from Danny at 2200 when he is co-hosting the Monocle Daily from Paris. Shashank Joshi, let's look at the reaction so far. François Hollande, we heard at the top of the programme saying France is at war. And indeed, within the last 24 hours, France has carried out airstrikes against ISIS in Syria. It's far more complicated than that, though, isn't it? Because, you know, they're not carrying airstrikes out in Brussels. Not that anyone is suggesting they should be, but that's where, some of the attackers have come from. Is there much that actually France gains from these attacks in Syria at the moment, other than a sense of feeling better?
I'm not sure there is. Most of the low-hanging fruit has been bombed and bombed again in the last year. There's a slight shift that actually the Paris attacks have achieved, which is the US and others, including France, are now bombing more oil-related sites in Syria, which is interesting. They were previously holding off from some of those, presumably for fear of civilian casualties, bombing, you know, civilian tanker trucks instead of military ones. But overall, no, there's not much they gain. I think the interesting thing is, on the one hand, there is a precedent for invoking the language of war in Article 5 of NATO, and that precedent is a double-edged sword. It's, of course, the September 11th attacks, and some people recoil at the rhetoric of we're at war with them, we heard in 2001, but it did, of course, mean that NATO backed the United States. On the other hand, what comes to mind repeatedly for me is Ankara suffered a major bombing last month. Turkey, last I checked, and for now at least, is a member of the alliance of NATO.
Second largest army within NATO.
And why wasn't that an Article 5 matter? And I think while I'm not of the sort of trendy idea that, well, we must shout Beirut and Yemen and every single place it's bombed every hour instead of just Paris, I do think there's an issue for NATO here. You can't ignore Ankara and focus on Paris.
Tim Marshall, there's another issue here, which is if you want to make the September 11th comparison, whatever people may have thought at the time, or certainly, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, looking back about the action in Afghanistan, there was a certain logic to it, even if you didn't agree with it, which was that the US had been attacked by Al-Qaeda, who were based in Afghanistan and were being sheltered by the government in Afghanistan, the Taliban. And the idea was that US troops would go into Afghanistan and rid Afghanistan of the Taliban if they didn't hand over bin Laden. That's not the same situation here at all, is it?
There are slight parallels. Insofar as Islamic State has got territory, the population that it subjugates is about 6 million strong, including some urban areas, and that several of the Paris murderers have been over there and have been, it would appear, been told, go back and carry this out. So that is a reason, I'm not saying it's the right or the wrong one, but it's a reason to bomb. You said, and Shashank put it very well, that, you know, there's not much left to bomb, and they actually have more bombs than targets. It is problematic. But I was reminded, it's a bit obscure, but in the very early 1960s, there was something called Beyond the Fringe. It was a comedy in the UK, and they used to have this sketch about an RAF pilot in World War II who was sent off on a mission over Germany. Almost certainly he wasn't going to come back. And he asked why, and he said, well, because we need a futile gesture at this stage. And a country that has been attacked in the way that France has been attacked, it needs a gesture. Even if they are gestures, gestures actually matter. Because a Security Council member with nuclear weapons engaged in the world with a view of itself that it holds is not going to do nothing. And you can argue whether it's a good or a bad thing what it's doing, but it will make these gestures.
But what comes after that gesture, Shashank? Because I think as we've seen throughout the military action that's been taken against ISIS, whether that's in Syria or originally in Iraq, it's been quite hard to work out an overarching strategy. There have been tactics from time to time.
That's right.
But a strategy for how you, as Obama likes to call it, degrade and defeat ISIS, so far there is none.
Well, I think the central problem for that has been the absence of someone to go into Raqqa, exploit the bombs falling from very expensive aircraft, and chase people out of their homes, that is ISIS. I found it very interesting because it can go two ways. You kind of cut out France saying, we will redouble our approach, which has been to say Assad must go. Assad is the cause of ISIS. There will be no peace without Assad. But I've seen reports today suggesting that certain French officials are saying we should reconsider this prioritization. Now, I personally think that's a very dangerous and alluring approach that will not yield results. But I do wonder if at this point, with Hollande saying he's going to coordinate with both Putin and Obama, that we are going to see ourselves slip into a much more pro-Russian policy, and Assad is going to be the beneficiary
here. It's the director of travel, Steve. I mean, it's funnily enough, just 2 weeks ago, the British Chief of Defence Staff, the CDS, most senior military man in the UK, strayed into politics and said pretty much that. You know what, we need to talk to Putin. You know what, we're letting our allies down. And lo and behold, 2 weeks later, because this has happened, Former President Sarkozy has said we need to talk to Putin and have an alliance. Marine Le Pen, who the National Front speaks for a significant part of France these days.
And also has a very large loan from a Russian bank, which I'm sure has no influence on what she thinks
at all. Oh, none whatsoever, Steve, you cynic. Hang on. We have seen yesterday Obama and Putin head-to-head for 30 minutes talking, and these are guys that don't like each other. You know, I've never seen them so close. Today, Prime Minister Cameron has been with Putin talking. Hollande is talking about this idea. It is approaching the centre of the debate about whether there will be a loose NATO alliance plus Putin and some Arab countries that will all come in together against ISIS. It's a nightmare.
And yet, Shashank, surely it doesn't have to be that way. It doesn't have to be the West moving towards Russia's position. There is an argument that you can put to Putin, which is, look at the more than 200 lives your country has lost with the Sharm el-Sheikh disaster. Look at the situation in Syria. Syria's problem is not simply ISIS. You don't fix Syria without getting rid of Assad as well.
I don't think persuasion tends to work in international politics. I know it sounds like a banal statement, but there are very few cases of other countries reasoning others into a change in policy. I did see a report in the Times of Israel today suggesting that Putin had told Assad either go or you will be forced to go. I don't give that too much credence, unfortunately, because I think if you were Putin and you are watching Hollande say the things he's saying, but more importantly, you're watching the last 2 months of shift in Europe, people coming to Putin's door, the sense that he's in charge, people here, think of luminaries like Sir Malcolm Rifkind, Sir Richard Dannett, all of whom are proceeding along these lines. Just wait, because you know Europe will fall into your lap. You get to keep Tartus, you get to keep your friends in Syria, perhaps not Assad, but some very high ups around him. Why make concessions now at this very sensitive time when France is outraged and will be the driving force for a change in policy? But let's just say one thing. First of all, two things. First of all, our allies will be irritated at this, the Arab states and Turkey, of course, as well, both of which will not be persuaded by the idea that keeping Assad is the way to go. And secondly, there's a strategic issue here, because you can topple them from Raqqa, you can topple them from Mosul, they will come back. We did it before. We kicked al-Qaeda in Iraq out of Western Iraq, out of Anbar province. They just came back. So what is different this time?
Well, on that point then, Tim, that question that Shashank's just raised there of essentially, what's the point? They'll just come back. How do we deal with this in a broader sense so that they don't come back, or at least they don't come back in such a violent way?
Militarily, they have to be dealt with. The French are putting the Charles de Gaulle aircraft carrier out again to double their firepower. The Americans are already doing a lot. More people are going to. They are going to get hammered. They will go eventually, because of military means, the way of al-Qaeda. They will be degraded, their leadership will be killed, their foot soldiers will be killed in large numbers, and eventually they'll overreach. But just as IS replaced AQ, somebody will replace IS unless you also go after the ideology. And that's the toughest thing of all to crack, and it's the most sensitive and delicate and difficult thing to talk about. Militarily, this is doable, but you just... it's whack-a-mole, as the Americans say. You hit something on a head and it pops up in another hole unless you deal with the ideology, and that's the difficult subject.
Do you share that analysis, Shashank?
It's what does ideology mean? Let's unpack that, because it's not just about what we would initially think of as being ideology. Radicalization, extremism, Wahhabism.
Teachings and belief systems.
You're absolutely right, but I think there's a political aspect to it as well, which I was alluding to, which is majority Sunni grievance in Iraq, in Syria, which I know we've talked about for years now. People may be bored of hearing about the fact that, you know, there are disgruntled Sunnis in Iraq. They don't like what Baghdad is doing. Obviously, they don't like what Damascus is doing to them, and now what Moscow's doing. But ultimately, they will welcome in some form of revanchist, Sunni, chauvinist, militaristic group. And even if you address some of the extremist ideas, the Islamist ideas, there will still be Sunni chauvinist groups operating in the Levant for years to come. But we cannot expunge them by force.
But that doesn't... I don't think that conflicts with anything I said. I think we're both pushing the same way. I agree with you. This is also political, and the Sunni majority of Syria wants a solution to this, which, let's be fair, leaves them in charge of most of Syria. And that is probably going to be the end result, whether it's next year or the year after, on a federal basis. But And they will then try and kick out IS because they don't like all these loonies with their strange ideas. But then, nevertheless, those loonies and their strange ideas will go somewhere else, will get more territory, and we'll be back where we were, just somewhere else.
And I think
unless you deal with the ideology, the answer, as well as the politics.
The answer will be the Gulf, and it will be the Arabian Peninsula, and it will be North Africa.
And there's oil there.
We have enormous problems over the next decades that are propping up in these places. And ISIS's affiliate, Sinai Province, which has blown a Russian plane out of the sky, Libya, Khorasan in Africa, Afghanistan, Pakistan, we're going to be talking about these for 10, 15 years to come.
And that's without even touching on the great issue of Saudi Arabia, which, frankly,
Which is where the ideology comes from.
And to whom we sold $2 billion worth of bombs today, by the way.
I think on that note, we'll move on. I want to look at this idea of freedom of movement throughout Europe. Now, there are two issues to unpack here. One is, immediately after the attacks, François Hollande said, "We're closing the borders as a as an immediate safeguard." And Tim Marshall, there was some logic to that, wasn't there? And it perhaps helped.
France has seven borders, which is partially explains why the gangsters down in Marseille, when they want to rob a bank or one of those big trucks that moves money around, they use a rocket-propelled grenade to blow them up. You know, the gangsters down there can get RPGs because it's got seven borders, all of which are open. All you need to do is get it through one. You can go straight into France and distribute it to wherever you want. So that logic says close those borders. But there's two problems with that. One is that you are then giving in to terrorism in that it has changed your way of life. But equally importantly, after the 2008 crash, the economies are not still particularly healthy, and the costs go up enormously once you start putting in passport controls and all the rest of it, and the lorries are all backed up. So it is doubly problematic. But if you're going to put the safety of your people first, I think you're going to take that route first and then look at what to do later. But listen, there's this buzz phrase going around at the moment of Fortress Europe. I think it's conceptually wrong. It's not going to be Fortress Europe with a big sort of ring around Europe. It's going to be Fortress Nation State. Each nation state is going to put up the barriers around
Balkanization.
Itself. Yes.
We'll move on to the issue of refugees in a moment because I think it's a separate one. But on this issue, Shashank, of borders and nations having control over their own borders, perhaps it's far too early to say, but do you think it's possible that in 20 years' time we'll look back on this great experiment of visa-free travel, within Europe, which, frankly, we hadn't really seen apart from back during the Roman Empire, and say it was this strange anomaly?
No, I don't know. I wonder if I look around the world and I see, I mean, Tim will know better than I do, but in South Asia, for example, which I do know a bit better, groups like SARC, the South Asian Association of Regional Cooperation, they aspire to this. They may not say that and they may not give it away in public. But
South America as well, they want to.
That's what they want. They look at us and they don't see us as some sort of crazy postmodern loons. They see us as the wave of the future and liberal-minded postmodern people who actually know the right way about doing this, who are creating societies that are more closely connected. And they see the economic benefits of that above all, I think.
But do we then have to accept that if we are going to have open borders and free movement of people, that, and yes, there will be huge economic and cultural benefits, but there will be costs that we could possibly not have if we had tighter borders?
I think yes, and that will partly depend on how politicians play it. Will they highlight the costs or will they highlight how dangerous this is? The United States right now, we're seeing very much the latter. I think it does place a premium on two things. First of all, the weakest point, the weakest links. In our case, for example, that's Turkey, the frontline states. And second of all, it places an enormous premium on intelligence sharing. And I think some of the most important news from today actually is that the United States has said all intelligence will be shared with France to the maximum extent allowed by law. In other words, with a state that is not in the Five Eyes Alliance.
There's another issue here in terms of border control, Tim, which is that if you're sitting in Germany, you might think that your border guards are pretty good and they're well paid and they're professional and they don't take bribes. Are you going to be as comfortable with, let's say, Bulgaria?
No, which goes back to my point about it'll be fortress nation state. We're not going to, which is why Schengen is dying before our eyes, and it needs to, it's on life support, and people need to, if they believe in it, Schengen needs to be held up as something that has massively helped Europe. But the problem is we are going to deal with emotion here. The moment it was found that one of the guys had a Syrian passport and may have come through Greece this year, immediately everyone says, right, that's it. I want closed borders immediately. And I said emotion because there's a partial analogy with the United States here. It's very emotional. I think it's the Second Amendment, the right to carry, to bear arms. They're very, very emotional about it, and they think it makes them safer. The fact that since 2001, 406,000 Americans have died from gunshot wounds, that sort of empirical evidence is irrelevant against the emotion of my right to bear arms.
So why can't we fund it? Why don't, if we want Schengen to succeed, if we worry about the weak links, worry about the Bulgarians, we should be paying them. It's in our interest to do so.
It needs voices like yours,
but of course,
therefore,
in terms of populist terms, it's a brave, brave politician who stands up on a stump and says, more money for Bulgaria. So that's one of your issues. But really, if we could frame this as, I mean, we have no problem, the US has no problem giving billions to Israel and Egypt. We give lots of money to the Kurds. If we could frame this as a security issue, and here it's a bit cynical because I'm calling for militarizing, securitizing, and frightening people, I wonder if you'd be a little more successful.
Let's move on to the issue of refugees, which you mentioned there, Tim. And it's, you know, we had two different responses over the last 48 hours from politicians. The first was the new right-wing government in Poland. Within,
hours.
Bodies weren't even cold
before
they said, right, that's it, no more refugees. And then you had Angela Merkel, who very pointedly in the last 24 hours has said, not only can we not blame this on refugees, but we need to deal with this whole issue in Syria for the millions of refugees that have come here.
It was the refugee crisis and the pictures we saw across the summer which has propelled the diplomacy we're now seeing to get a Syrian political solution. Added and aided, you could argue, by the Russian moves. I mean, they've made themselves at the centre of the argument and they made themselves indispensable to the solution. So we have finally arrived, after 4 years, at a potentiality of a diplomatic solution which might help the fighting to stop. But it took the refugee crisis to do that. When enough people were persuaded, politicians, hang on a minute, you mean they're going to keep coming and keep coming and keep coming until that war has stopped? Oh, we better stop that war. So those two things have gone hand in glove. But I just think the horse has bolted. I think that the populations of the different EU states feel that horse has gone. I don't care. And you can hear the drawbridge is being pulled up. And rational arguments, perhaps cloaked in the way you just described it, Shashank, rational arguments are not being listened to. Once you get past Paris, which will take, unless something else happens, 2 or 3 weeks, only at that point will the more calmer voices that will dare to say things like that into microphones, if they're a politician. Because Marine Le Pen's, you're going to see her poll figures rise. They did after Charlie Hebdo, and she didn't even say anything.
Although she didn't politically gain too much after Charlie Hebdo. I mean, what I think needs to be said, though, and we haven't said this explicitly, the link between Paris and refugees is almost non-existent at this point. We do have two cases of people who fought in Syria. I think it's two, maybe.
You're being logical again.
And there's, of course, one case of one of these individuals who was processed as a refugee through first Greece and then it's
Serbia.
However, as has been pointed out and should be repeated, Syrian passports are very easy to get, and if you're a refugee, that's easy because they will help you get through. So they're even legitimate refugees will want a Syrian passport because it will ease their passage. And of course, the famous case is one in the name of the Dutch Prime Minister, which was secured. So I think we must be very, very careful in even us talking about it like this, as if there is a link, in asserting that has not yet been proven. And if it was, it would be one case out of how many we've had so far, I don't know, but hundreds of thousands.
Tim, you mentioned before about drawing up the drawbridge and about emotional arguments versus rational arguments. But if you do draw up the drawbridge, you then get a lot of emotional arguments the other way, because we're going to have a lot of dead bodies in the Mediterranean again. Mm.
Yes.
People are going to keep coming.
Yeah, it's going to happen anyway.
That's undeniable. They will keep coming, even if it's Fortress Europe or Fortress Nation States.
Yes, as long as the wars keep going. Although it's about 40% of people coming across are Syrian. In fact, I think one of the largest groups of people from Albania and Kosovo, and there's a move in the EU to say they will not be given refugee status because there is no war there. But sorry, that's an aside. Yes, they're going to keep coming, and that's why you've got very unpalatable and unpleasant answers being put forward, such as the Australian one, where, you know, you'd put boats out there and tow them off to an island and leave them there. And I'm not advocating that, but, you know, your rationality and, forgive me for assuming it, your liberalism, Stephen, is not...
You can assume it's fine.
Thank you. Well, it's less
secret
widely...
Fascist.
It's less widely shared these days. I mean, I honestly think that the UK may well vote to leave the European Union. We haven't really had the whole debate and the economics, but this, what's going on right now, and you can decouple Paris from refugees if you want, because you are a rational, liberal, humane person. But I'm telling you that the great swathes of the electorate are not going to uncouple it.
I want to move on just before the end to look at this idea of the Western liberal way of life, because it seems like this attack, compared to others, makes it far harder for everything to carry on as before. After September the 11th, you could say, well, there are checks at airports and everything else is fine. After Madrid, it was about trains. But this is a local restaurant. This could be anyone's local restaurant. It could be anyone's bar. We can't put armed police out there. Cities are open places. What can we even think about doing, Shashank?
Well, there's two things. First of all, I'm absolutely convinced Paris could have been far worse. And that's the case because I know Mumbai very well, and I know how incompetent, how awful the Indian police and services were 7 years ago. And I know that European agencies, intelligence, security, military police, SWAT, have been preparing for exactly this. And I know that their professionalism saved lives last week. So that's number one. Invest in those resources, keep funding them, let them train. I also think it's interesting that both John Brennan, the head of the CIA, John Saws, former head of MI6, have written in the last 24 hours about how important bulk intercept collection is and surveillance. Here I'm not convinced, and I'm not convinced because I know that Paris, France, already has more extensive powers than the UK. They had them in January for Charlie Hebdo, they have them now, and bulk intercept is more useful for retrospective analysis, for finding suspects. It's not so useful for preventing attacks in this way, so I hope they do not use this too opportunistically to interfere in that cryptographic encryption debate that is also taking place.
Well, it's about, I mean, that's going to just walk through.
Let's move on from that, because okay. I want to just focus on this idea of how we all go about living our lives now.
Well, exactly as Shashank has said, in this country, the UK intercept bill will go through and there will be that bulk trawling of data. We will carry on in 2 to 3 weeks. I mean, there's a football match at Wembley Stadium tomorrow, friendly between England and France, and the English are allegedly going to sing the French national anthem, and we're all going to stand shoulder to shoulder in solidarity, and everyone that goes is going to be very nervous. And in about 3 weeks, you'll be going along to a football match without even thinking about it, and then there'll be another attack. We are going to carry on with our way of life more or less the same, and then we're going to do all the things we've talked about, and the thing we haven't talked about, Steve, getting to the root of the ideology. And until we do that, it'll come back and back and back.
Shashank, are you as confident that, I mean, people often say after events like this, you know, things will never be the same again, and yet, you know, on the whole, things tend to be.
Absolutely. 10 years ago, 7/7, I think that we have this incredible psychologically ingrained inability to take the long view. We are trapped in the moment. We forget that it was once there were crises before and they passed. I'm a little bit perturbed, although not alarmed just yet, by Hollande's rhetoric today in front of the Parliament on extending the state of emergency by 3 months.
3 months.
That's a long time for any European state to be able to detain people without a warrant and, you know, do all sorts of other things. I'm a little bit worried by that, and I know we've seen these debates play out in the UK 10 years ago as well, but it's the social level, at the cultural level. I keep the statistics in mind, and I reassure myself, my family, of that, that I am more likely to be killed crossing the road to go to mass concerts or events than I am getting shot on the way. And so I always keep that in view. It's a slight comfort to me. I'm not sure if it is to everyone, though.
We shall prevail.
Fair enough, we shall prevail. Shashank Joshi and Tim Marshall, thank you both very much indeed for joining us for this very special edition of Midori House. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow with two other guests, I imagine talking about many of the same issues, although I'm sure lots will have changed over the next 24 hours. A little later at 2200, it's the Monocle Daily. Again, as I said before, we'll be co-hosting that from Paris. Daniel Jacopelli will be hosting from there. But for now, though, my name is Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.